This is David's Book Talk, bringing authors and book lovers together in a unique way since 2009. Visit us at davidsbooktalk.com and join the conversation at facebook.com/davidsbooktalk. But first, pull up a chair, relax, and enjoy today's episode. Here's your host, David English.
Hello and welcome to David's Book Talk, and boy, do we have a special author today. Yes, it's Nelson DeMille. The number one New York Times best-selling author. His new book is called Radiant Angel, and it's a John Corey novel. Hello.
David, good to be with you.
It's good to have you back on the show. It's been a few years since we talked.
And yes.
John Corey is back, and I love John Corey, I must tell you. I think he's great.
I like him because he pays the rent for me.
I like his sense of humor. That's one of the things I really like about him. He's got this real sarcastic sense of humor. Is that what you have too?
Apparently, yeah. I've been told. To me, it's a natural thing, but I guess it was an attribute I didn't know. I could make money out of.
Are the John Corey novels harder to write than anything else you've written?
Well, that's a good question. In fact, a unique question. Nobody's ever asked me that. The character is really one of the easiest. I kind of know this guy. He sprang fully born, developed out of my head. He's easy. It's the plot, because there a lot of it has to do with technology and terrorism and that type of thing. Yeah, I do a lot of research. I want to get it right. If it's an important subject, I want to make it up. So the books are hard to write in that respect, but easy in terms of the characters. I kind of know all the characters by now.
And John is, I laughed just thinking about him. And I think to myself, this man is not relationship material at all. Good God, the man is working all the time. He never has time for women.
Well, sort of like Don Draper on Mad Men.
Exactly.
But the women love him, and the guys like him, which is the important thing. I mean, he's a man's man. Men love this guy. I was very surprised to see how many women love this guy. I mean, I get literally over the years thousands of emails to my website saying that these women are telling me that they're in love with John Corey.
Well, who's going to play John Corey in the movies, do you think?
Well, we're working on a TV series, actually, for the whole Corey series, and Sony kind of owns the characters, Columbia Sony TV, and they we're talking to AMC, HBO, and TNT. And the guy who was interested was Aaron Eckhart, who's a very good actor, but not as well known as some others. And and we're talking to other people, but and TV, cable TV is hot at the moment, so finding actors is not as difficult as it was years ago. Leading men and leading women. So hopefully we get the whole series done on one of the cable networks.
What's interesting, you mentioned Don Draper, and I think about Don Draper, and the fun part of Don Draper was watching him self-destruct.
Right.
And you just watch the man just totally melt down in front of us. But John Corey never does it. John Corey's got this strength in him that, where does it come from? He's just a strong lead. He's like a strong leading man. He's just
kind of old-fashioned. I'm Humphrey Bogart. That whole crew. These guys were, strong silent types. We don't even use that terminology anymore. He might not be so silent, but he's a strong man. He knows who he is. Women like him because he gets the job done, whatever the job is, and they know they can rely on him to, not wimp out. And I created him as kind of a counterweight to some of the sensitive young men we have today, and including actors. And also, he was, when I set out to get this guy's personality down, well, one of the first things I thought about is that he's going to be politically incorrect. That was the only thing I started with, a politically incorrect person who can say things that I can't say.
So, exactly.
And I got away with that. The other day was a little shaken up when she first read it. She said, "What the hell is this?" I said, go with this. Trust me on this one. But then I kind of made him, he was a little bit, maybe too clownish at first, but he kind of calmed down a little bit, and he's a little bit more of a man's man.
So how old is John Corey in this book?
Oh, gosh. That's a question we don't want to answer, because
Really?
The problem is with these series characters is that, you know, as the years go by, the character's getting older unless you can kind of freeze time. And the first John Corey book was Plum Island. I didn't know it was going to be a series. It was meant to be a standalone book, so I put him in his early 40s then. But as the years go by, and every writer who creates a series has to be really aware that, you know, if it's a successful series, the years are going by and the character's getting older and older. And I don't know if you remember, but when Agatha Christie died, they didn't put her obituary on the front page of the New York Times. They put the obituary of Hercule Poirot, her character.
Right.
And they estimated his age at 103. Why? Because she'd been writing this guy for 50 years, and yeah, we should all have those problems. But John is John knows he's getting older chronologically, but he's in a system that he's going to pick an adolescent age that he likes and stick with it.
That's the amazing thing. When I used to read Nancy Drew as a kid, Nancy Drew never aged. She never got older than 18. She was always 18 in every single book, and it was kind of like, it was nice because you saw the same Nancy Drew every book. You didn't see the gray hairs or feel that she was getting older or had headaches and pains or anything. You never had any of that.
Right. 18 is a good age, I'll take it.
Exactly. I mean, 18 is a good age. When I first saw the title of this book, Radiant Angel, I thought, wait a minute, Radiant Angel? That doesn't sound like a Nelson DeMille book. It sounds totally different.
Yeah, it's not a spiritual book, I can assure you. The a little bit of backstory about that. You know, and you read the book, so John Corey's new job is with the Diplomatic Surveillance Group, which in the FBI they call these people, they call it a quiet end, meaning like a dead end, and that's John's been kind of demoted. The actual name is the Special Surveillance Group, but I call it the Diplomatic Surveillance Group just to change it a bit. So, because it's called a quiet end, that's what the FBI calls it. I decided to call the book A Quiet End, and that was a working title for many years as I was working on it, and everybody seemed happy with it, but then, for some reason, the publishers became unhappy with it, and they picked up on a phrase in the book, which is Radiant Angel, for a title. Radiant Angel is a nuclear detection operation, so, you know, an FBI or the NEST group, N-E-S-T group, comes around, goes around and with their very, very sensitive radiation detectors doing a radiation sweep in New York and I'm sure elsewhere. It's called the Radiant Angel Operation, Operation Radiant Angel. So that's where that title came from. But in the UK, interestingly, they love my original title, and in the UK it's called A Quiet End.
Really?
Yeah.
How interesting.
Never happened before. The American title and the UK title have always been the same.
Were they released at the same time?
Yeah, the same day. People are getting confused, but the good news is people have bought both of them, thinking that they're getting two different books, but it's the same book.
It's the same exact
book. A woman came to me the other day at a book signing, and she said, "I've got two books, and they turn out to be the same book, so you got to sign them both." She took it well, but and we didn't mean to do that, but when you get them online, you can wind up with A Quiet End from the UK.
Right. Now, I was just talking to somebody in the Philippines, and they had already read this new book, which amazed me. So it's already available in the Philippines, too.
Yeah, probably. Well, English language, of course, and probably it was the American Export Edition in the Philippines. And yeah, somebody wrote to me from, emailed me from India, and they'd already read it before it was out in the British Export Edition. The export editions tend to be shipped earlier,
right?
And read earlier, so you get some news from the hinterlands before the book actually hits the stands here.
Do you still enjoy writing as much as you always have?
Honestly, no. I enjoy. You know, the saying in the business is, "I hate writing, but I love having written."
Oh yeah.
So that's it. I mean, when I'm done, it's done, and I wish I could enjoy the process more. But as I get older, there are, you know, you see time slipping by and the things you want to do.
Right.
But I enjoy it from a technical standpoint. I enjoy the challenge. It gives me a lot of mental stimulation all day, but it's time consuming. And I think I could enjoy it again, like a lot of writers my age are doing. What they're doing is just slowing up, and they're not writing as many hours a day. I mean, I should be retired at my age if I was in any other job, but nobody retires from writing, really.
Yeah, Stephen King tried it. Look where he got with that.
Yeah, I know.
It's amazing. I was very upset when I heard he was going to retire. I'm like, hey, what do I do without a Stephen King book?
Yeah, he's a genius. He's an absolute genius. And, you know, I thought he really meant it because he's so prolific that you say, well, he's got a body of work out there.
He doesn't need to write.
Yeah. He doesn't need to write. He doesn't need the money. But he also, his reputation is so good. And what a lot of writers are afraid of, just like baseball players, is that, you know, we don't know when to do the Joe DiMaggio. We don't know when we're at the top of our game. And then you write that one more book that really flops. And you said, I should have stopped and left the body of work, which was good the way it was before I started going downhill. And I think we all fear that.
Yeah, you want to be remembered as somebody who did quality work all the time. I mean, you see these authors out there putting books out, book after book after book, and some of them are just not good. I mean, they're just not good books.
Have you noticed? Yeah.
Yeah, I have noticed that. I won't name any names. I'm not out here to out anybody, but I mean, I want to read a really good book every time, and it's so difficult to find good books sometimes. There are good authors, but finding a really great book.
Yeah, I know, and even the good authors are being pressured to do a book a year. And, you know, look, the reader has spent a lot of money on this book, and it's going to invest an incredible amount of time. I mean, you're talking 6 to 18 hours, depending on the length of the book, and that's a lot of investment time in an age when, you know, go on the internet, and you can watch a half an hour TV show, and you can do a lot of things. So you really owe it to the reader.
What I like about this book, and I should mention, it's from Grand Central. I don't think I mentioned the publisher, Grand Central, is that I can see the scenes in my head. The scenes on. Well, I won't give away too much, but I can see the scenes at the beginning, the middle, the end, and there's one particular scene right in the middle of the book that's really got to me, and I think you know what scene I'm talking about. I won't mention it, but one of the.
Was it the one? Let me guess. You raised my curiosity. Was it the one in the Indian cemetery?
No.
Okay.
No, it was the big one in the middle of the book.
All right. Okay.
The big violent scene.
Violent scene. Okay.
Yeah, reading that, it was very. First of all, it was very difficult for me to read. It was, you know, it was very, very intense. I felt like I was watching Pulp Fiction or something. You know?
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
And it's so realistic. The way you write it, it's just so realistic to me. And everything, I just remember these scenes in my head. And that's what makes you a good writer. I mean, the fact that we can visualize all this stuff in our heads.
Oh, thank you. You know, and that's what takes the time. You can't, unless you're Stephen King, you know, who again is a genius. But the rest of us have to rework and rework it. You don't have that kind of time. I'm sorry. I don't know how these people can do a book a year. It takes me, you know, at least 14 months, that includes the research, but I do about 6 drafts. Well, because when I send it to the editor, I mean, the editors in the old days were kicking back to you, saying this is, you know, the old funny expression was, you know, your work is both good and original, however, what's good is not original, and what's not good. And that was, you know, you used to get some real sarcasm and tough editing from the editors, but when you're a best-selling author, some of the stuff goes to the editor's desk, and they just want to publish it. They don't want to edit. They want to publish it. It's all money in the bank. So you have to become your own best editor, which is what I try to do.
Exactly. And, there's so many books out there, and so little time. I mean, how long do we live? We live, if we're lucky, we live 70 or 80 years, and there's only so much time to read. So we want to read good things. And I constantly, once I read a really good book, I think to myself, now I got to find another one that's just as good. And that, it gets harder and harder as you try to find those good books.
Absolutely. That's why I read a lot of the classics that I've already read, you know, but I want to read them again. I read another, you know, I'll do a Somerset, every summer I'll do a Somerset Maugham, or I'll do a Graham Greene. That's my treat for the summer reading.
Do you do a lot of TV watching?
No, not really. The only show I ever followed, the only series on cable was actually Mad Men.
Oh.
Well, Larry Davidson's the only two I ever watched on a consistent basis. I watch the news. I'm a news junkie. But then I do, you know, other than that, no, I don't really.
It's funny because Mad Men, I could not explain to you why I liked that show other than the fact that the acting was so good.
Yeah,
and the situations were sometimes hysterical and sometimes so heavily dramatic that I just enjoyed that.
I know, and it was, you know, again, for somebody who doesn't watch TV, I was impressed. And every once in a while, you know, the writers get some magic going, and that's what I saw there. I saw magic, and it also just reminded me, those of us of a certain age, I remember the early 60s when this book began, rather when this show begins, and I remember smoking in restaurants and bars, and smoking every place except, you know, while you're pumping gas, and drinking, you know, I think we all overindulge in the hard liquor in those days. Anybody who drank wine was, you know, considered a little bit of a sissy if you beat them up, you know, but the world has changed, and it's just so funny that it's contemporary history. And yet, and the world has gotten so much different than it was a short time ago.
It's nostalgic, too, the show, and you saw things that you hadn't seen in years, so it brings back all those memories of when you were younger.
Right, it does, actually.
And you just enjoy it so much. Now, we had talked before in the interview about doing the TV show about John Corey, you know. Do you think it's really going to happen?
I think so, yeah. You know, I mean, Sony owns the character rights, basically. They don't own every book. They're behind it. And also, I know HBO is behind it. HBO's interested, I'll say, behind it. And TNT is, and definitely AMC are interested. And it just totally lends itself to a series. We almost got the series off the ground. They were going to do Plum Island first. They're very close to actually being done. But we couldn't get a commitment from them to do the rest of them. It's just, you know, a lot of agent haggling. But it's out there. Everybody in cable land knows about the John Corey character, and I think people want it. I think it's also important to find somebody. The guy who was absolutely interested was Aaron Eckhart. But he's big, but not big enough to really make it happen by snapping his fingers. So,
right.
You know, and I have a good agent. You know, I have a really good agency behind me on the West Coast. So, there's no guarantee in Hollywood anything's going
to
happen.
I'm trying to, as we're talking, I'm trying to picture in my mind who would be a good John Corey.
Bruce Willis, or maybe a younger Bruce Willis.
You know, I was thinking the same thing. Somebody like him. Who do we have that's young looks like Bruce Willis nowadays?
Somebody's a wise ass like that.
I mean, Matt Dillon's too old now. He's in his, I guess, 40s or 50s now. You think about it. It's hard. It's hard to imagine who would be really good at it until you actually saw the test thing or, you know, whatever. And then
you'd be surprised, though. You know, I was surprised when they told me Travolta was going to be my character, Paul Brenner and General's Daughter. Paul Brenner was South Irish and kind of a tough wise guy. He was like a Bruce Willis kind of character, too. And the character Brennan, they told me John Travolta. I said, oh, my God. I mean, are you kidding? And yet, when that guy got on the stage, because he's a brilliant actor, mm-hmm. he became Paul Brenner. So, you know, and the same with The Godfather. If you remember, The Godfather himself was Marlon Brando. When I said it was Marlon Brando, everybody said the same thing. You know, bad pick is going to be terrible. But he became the Godfather, so if the actor's good enough, they can carry it off. They can pull it off.
Right. Now, you still live in Long Island?
I do, yes.
Do you get recognized when you walk around town?
Well, my town, yeah, I do. I mean, you know, just about any place on Long Island, you know, I've been to a lot of local media. I do local TV and that type of thing. And a lot of times in Manhattan, the good thing about being recognized, it's good when your name is recognized, and then when I'm trying to make a dinner reservation, you know.
Right.
My wife calls, and she, you know, she was in public relations, so she was getting a reservation at a good, you know, hot restaurant, and she says, this is for Mr. Nelson DeMille, you know who he is, and da 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 da. So that works, so that's good, and we like that. But the facial recognition, usually around Long Island, sometimes in Manhattan, but every once in a while, you know, I'm out of town. Somebody comes up to me, which is kind of unusual for, you know, somebody to recognize a novelist.
Right. It's not like acting where they follow you around with cameras. Hide in the bushes and wait for you to leave your house.
Yeah, I know.
Now, is there going to be an eighth and ninth John Corey book, do you think?
I think so. I want to keep him fresh. It's easy to keep him alive, barely alive, but you got to keep him fresh at the same time. And when a good plot lends itself to a Corey, a Corey character, I will do that. My next book is not a John Corey, but probably the one after would be, yeah.
Oh, wow. Can you tell us anything about the next book, or is it under...
Yeah, no, it's actually set in Havana, or mostly in Havana. So it's actually all over Cuba. It's an action-adventure book. It starts off in Miami with Cuban exile, anti-Castro types, and then it goes down to Key West, Green Parrot, the famous Green Parrot bar in Key West, to hang out with a lot of characters, sort of like a Casablanca kind of thing.
Right.
And our hero is, a guy who's an Iraqi war vet, and he gets this assignment to go into Castro's Cuba and to find something. Well, I won't give too much of it away, but why I thought of it, of course, is because of the opening to Cuba, and I think it's a good thing, basically, we don't screw it up. They don't screw it up. I think it'll be interesting for, both countries. But also, it's in the news, and it's going to be in the news for the next year and a half. So by the time I finish the book and it gets out, Cuba will be, one way or the other, we're going to know what's happening there.
Now, does Nelson DeMille have author friends that he hangs out with?
I do. For a long time I resisted that. But, as the years go on, every first Tuesday of the month we have an author's round table that gets together. And we sit around and we go to the same restaurant in Manhattan.
Oh, that's cool.
And we don't talk literature. What we do is complain about advances and agents and sales and royalties. But it's kind of fun. It's very cathartic. And I can give you a couple of the names. Lee Child.
Oh, my God.
Harlan Coben.
Wow.
Linda Fairstein, Susan Isaacs, Mary Higgins Clark, Justin Scott, and a few others. We have 12, but we usually can manage to round up 8 in any given first Tuesday of the month.
You can say somebody's not busy, Mary's getting up there. She's not as young as she used to be, but she's still going strong.
Oh, she's going strong. She's the one who misses almost none of those meetings. It's amazing. We're all either doing something else, but, if Mary's around, she will be at the meeting. And then also, my daughter Carol Higgins Clark is one of the round tablers, as we call it.
That sounds like fun. I mean, it's good to have things to look forward to like that every month,
Exactly, because it's such a lonely, isolating profession, and that's one of the reasons we did it. We said, we sit in rooms all day talking to ourselves, and it's good to get out to the world and see what everybody else is thinking, and we do talk a little business, but not literature, but business. Because we have things, you're self-employed and you're isolated, so you need to you have to kind of reach out and form a little bit of a network.
I missed this book already, just being done it. Now I'm like, oh, I wish I had another one to read,
That's how I... glad. I should tell you, too, that it's going to debut at number one New York Times.
Seriously?
Yeah, it'll debut at number one in the print bestseller list, and also the ebook bestseller list, and also the combined. So it's very rare when you get one book to do a clean sweep of the three bestseller lists. Because they've got three now. It used to be just the print, but now it's print and ebook and combined. So
that's amazing.
They're doing number one on each one of those lists. Wow. And that was good news I got.
Congratulations. That's amazing.
I wasn't shocked, but I knew I would make at least one of those three lists, but I made them all at number one, so that was good.
The first thing that surprised me about it when I picked up this book was how short it was. I thought, well, this is the shortest John Corey book, I think, yet, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, absolutely, and it may be my shortest book ever. I usually write the long book, but I realize that they're paying me the same.
There you go.
When I checked my contract, there was nothing in there about words, so I said, let me... But I did it consciously. I wanted this book to be tight, very, very tight. And I wanted to see if I could do it, because I am really sometimes long, and people appreciate long novels, love them. People don't. So I wanted to, go for that shorter book that a lot of contemporary authors are writing now.
Right, and it works effectively. It's a very effective book. I mean, it's a book you're very satisfied after it's done, which is very important. I mean, I don't know about you, but when I finish a book, I want to feel like it's been worth the reading. It's been worth my time, and I really felt this one was. And there are some books I have trouble getting through. I'm sure you felt the same experience. Where you just you got through it, but then you wondered, why did I even bother? Some of the writing wasn't what I wanted it to be.
Yeah, that's the other thing. Even a short book could be bad, obviously. You know, some of the short classics that I grew up with, like Brave New World and All Quiet on the Western Front, and these were notoriously short books. And yet they, you know, books like that have changed the world. So you say, well, gosh, I mean, can you really tell a story that powerful in that short a format? And yeah, you can if you are a good writer who knows, has an economy of words. And I was not like that, but I, you know, decided I needed to do that. I needed to be able to, especially in this day and age where people's attention is so divided, I wanted to see if I could tell a novel-length story and it was an economy of words. I mean, word length. Computers tell us how many words we type now.
Now, will you be involved at all with the TV series if it does happen?
No, I don't think so. I don't want to be. I, it's not my thing, and I don't, you know, it doesn't pay a lot of money to the author. If I was looking to use my time most effectively, I would just be writing books and not messing around with this.
Right, exactly. I agree.
It's not like feature film. Feature film pays a lot. And, you know, authors have, been saved from starvation by movie advances. But TV is a whole different animal. They don't pay a lot, and you don't sell a lot of books. For instance, when General's Daughter came out, we put out a movie tie-in edition with John Travolta's face on the cover. We sold about 1 million paperbacks of General's Daughter.
Really?
Because it was a movie tie-in, but you know, that doesn't happen with TV. And, which is okay. But it's nice to just do it, and you know, you pick up some fans that way, and, you know, it's kind of, I guess, today with TV, it's kind of prestigious. Years ago, you didn't even talk about it. One of my books, Word of Honor, was a TNT movie years and years ago, and I didn't even mention it because nobody watched TNT and nobody watched Cablevision for anything serious, but Cablevision has come, you know, 1 million miles since then, so all the authors like Michael Connelly is another one who's really, really involved with cable TV.
Right, exactly. Although I Titus Welliver, I didn't see him as Harry Bosch. Now, I'm not criticizing his choice, but in my mind, he doesn't look like Titus Welliver. I don't know. I don't know what he looks like, but not like that. I don't know. We all have different ideas of what characters look like and how they're supposed to appear. I mean, people criticize different authors, but, oh, that character is nothing like the book character, you know, and you look at Rizzoli and Isles, you think, that's not who I pictured when I read the book. You know, it's all a perception for the fans, you know, what they see in their heads.
Yeah, well, everybody carries something different into it, and I think, you know, I mean, again, with Travolta, I never thought he was, you know, Paul Brenner.
Yeah.
But, you know, but if the act is good enough, you can get, you know, you can get away with it. Even more difficult is the female lead. You know, I mean, guys are, you know, constantly fantasizing about who, you know, what these women look like who are, what they're reading about in books, and they all, if you get 30 guys sitting in a room, they'll give you 30 different fantasies of what this woman should look like. With men, you know, it's a little bit different. You know, a lot of guys can kind of be interchangeable, but the female lead is as important. And the General's Daughter, they got Madeline Stowe, who's a great actress, but it was not that character. That was totally miscast, because she's just a little more classy than, you know, kind of an army brat, which was my character. And she didn't pull it off, but she is a great actress, but not for that role.
But I'm wondering about Tess, because I really like Tess. Are we going to see her again?
You know, I'm thinking about that, right? John's new trainee, buddy. Yeah, I mean, I kind of like the character.
I like her, too.
I would like to bring her back. I definitely would like to bring her back. But if you notice that one of John's old girlfriends, Beth Penrose, from Plum Island, was in this book.
Yes.
There are a lot of men... were really unhappy when I got rid of Penrose 5 books ago, so she's definitely coming back. She's I think she's a good strong character.
Oh yeah, she's a good foil for John too.
Yeah.
She can put him in his place, which I think is important. But I can't wait to see them all again. We have to let you go because you have things to do. But Nelson, as always, it's a treat. I love your books and I love it. You're such a good guy. Thank you so much.
David, thank you. It's a great interview. You made me think, which is good.
And this has been David's Book Talk. We'll talk to you next time.
You have just enjoyed the podcast of David's Book Talk, brought to you by your host, book lover David English. Please visit us at davidsbooktalk.com, follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and subscribe to our podcast. We want to hear from you, and we don't want you to miss our upcoming shows with top authors like Mary Higgins Clark, Patricia Cornwell, Lisa Scottolini, Jackie Collins, Nelson DeMille, Michael Connelly, Sue Grafton, Steve Martini, Dale Brown, David Baldacci.